the street lights around me, in the wall-to-wall prison of my city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, the nightclub at the end of the world, where everything that ends has a new beginning, and every new beginning has an end. I'm Carolyn Baker, and I'm sitting in tonight and next week for Mike Rupert, who's made his journey back to Northern California to live there again, and we send him our love and good wishes. I spoke with him last night, and he's arrived in Northern California, and he's doing very well. Meanwhile, tonight we have a fantastic guest whom I've been wanting to have on this show for a long time. And we're going to get right to the conversation, and during the last part of the show, we will open the phone lines for callers, because I have a feeling that many of our listeners are going to have comments and questions. My guest tonight is Frances Weller. Frances Weller, marriage and family therapist, is a psychotherapist, writer, and soul activist. He's a master of synthesizing diverse streams of thought from psychology, anthropology, mythology, alchemy, indigenous cultures, and poetic traditions. Author of Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, he has introduced the healing work of ritual to thousands of people. The core of his work is creating pathways to reclaiming our indigenous soul, what psychologist Carl Jung called the unforgotten wisdom that resides at the heart of the psyche. To further this work, he founded and directs Wisdom Bridge, an organization that offers educational programs that seek to integrate the wisdom from traditional cultures with the insights and knowledge gathered from Western cultures. Frances is an old friend of mine and colleague who I knew when I lived in Northern California about 20 years ago, and whose work I followed ever since. Welcome to the show, Frances.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you tonight, Carolyn.
I really, really appreciate your being here. And you know, one of the most powerful and profound statements that I've ever heard about grief is this quote from you. You say, "Grief is subversive, undermining the quiet agreement to behave and be in control of our emotions. It is an act of protest that declares our refusal to live numb and small. There is something feral about grief, something essentially outside the ordained and sanctioned behaviors of our culture. Because of that, grief is necessary to the vitality of the soul. Contrary to our fears, grief is suffused with life force." Now, many people believe that grieving and resistance or activism are mutually exclusive, and they think that if we're grieving, we're not resisting what we should be resisting, and that if we're resisting, we won't have time for grieving, as if grieving diminishes our capacity to resist. What has been your experience with this, Frances?
Well, actually, quite contrary. I think they're profoundly complementary practices. A lot of people who come to our grief gatherings are activists who are burnt out. They have turned their face into the strong wind of loss, you know, the accumulated loss of our times, whether it's species depletion or, you know, clear cut in the forest or whatever it is. They come because they have been weighed down by the weight of all the loss that they're facing. And if we have no means by which to set it down, that weight accumulates over time, and that is basically what burnout is. So I don't think that they're one or the other. I get a little nervous when we start to create these polarizations. I think they really need each other. The value of grief for the activist is that it helps keep the heart soft, helps keep the heart responsive and able to be in touch with what is happening in the world. So we're not just acting out of a moralistic stance, like we should do this, but it comes back down to a deeper level of love, of affection. It's something that has penetrated into the heart because the heart has been receptive to it. And that comes, I think when we move from that place, our resistance comes from a much deeper ground.
Yeah, I really like that. And, you know, just on this note, one of the things that you do say in your book is, you know, that having an open heart benefits not just me or you, but the entire community, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the closed heart. It's the heart that's been hardened by, you know, suffering that hasn't been mitigated by community or by a sense of shared sorrow that is able to do tremendous amounts of damage. And I remember Maladoma, from my friend Maladoma Somi, once saying that a person who cannot grieve is a great threat to the community. They're like a walking time bomb. Because what happens with unmetabolized sorrow, with grief that we're not able to really address, or a heart that is not able to stay open, is that it hardens and turns away from the larger sentiment of what is beneficial to all of us. We become highly self-centered in that state, and that's precisely what we're seeing, in a sense, you know, cross-culturally here.
Yes, and, you know, it just occurs to me as you're talking that we can be, you know, raving activists and very passionate and very effective at what we do in terms of resistance and activism, and yet not really be helping the community because our hearts are closed.
I think it's a very good point, Carolyn. We can really begin to polarize in that state. And I know there are certain things we must be absolutely against. I understand that, and I totally can cooperate with that. But we do need to do the practices that keep the primary reason I'm responding to what's going on, that it's coming out of a place from the heart, from the place of affection, from a place that recognizes a deeper bond or a deeper kinship with the rest of life.
I really, really like that. You know, presently, the human race is facing unprecedented challenges. We're facing the likelihood of global economic meltdown, and we're also witnessing the depletion of resources beyond anything the human race has ever experienced. You're living in the midst of the California drought, and in your state and myriad places around the world, clean, drinkable water is vanishing. And, of course, drought is only one symptom of catastrophic climate change, which I believe is now irreversible and may cause the extinction of human life and leave very few habitable places on the planet, at least by 2100. The notion of near-term extinction is now being talked about very openly by scientists, and Elizabeth Colbert's new book on the sixth great extinction is significantly bringing this topic out of the closet. In the light of this, some people would ask, what good does it do to grieve? We're screwed. We've killed the planet. Why not just leave the planet a little earlier than we had planned? Why not just do a lot of mind-altering substances or commit suicide right now? So really, truly, Francis, why is grief important now?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question, isn't it? I find myself somewhere between the idea that Joanna Macy puts out, that we're in the great turning, and somewhere between that and writing our obituary. I'm not exactly sure where we are in the process. But if we are in the throes of our own species disappearance, then, you know, what it really comes down to is good manners. You know,
I mean,
if we are leaving, then we owe it as an act of respect and manners to try to do whatever we can to mitigate against further damage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if our species is leaving, there will be others that remain. And if the salmon are returning, we should do whatever we can to make their waters clean and take down the obstacles to their ability to spawn. We should do whatever we can to make sure that the forest begins to go back to a full climax forest where everything and all species are able to return. We should do whatever we can, and that's an act, I think, of deep manners. And again, we come back to the heart, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, an example of that is, like, one of the dangers, I think, of even our psychological perspective is that we tend to project onto nature what's going on inside of us. So when we're driving past a clear cut, for instance, it's easy to project onto that, well, that's some reflection of my own interior state. But what if, as we're driving past a clear cut, I am actually feeling the sorrow of the place, that I'm actually a receptor site for feeling the grief of the trees, of the sorrel, of the owls, of all the creatures that were, lost their home and their habitat as a consequence. So my ability to feel that, and again we come back to grief work, my ability to register that, puts me back into a profound state of relatedness to where I live, to the watersheds, to my home. And so when you say, why grieve if this is the condition? Well, because we have to keep some sense of our deep soul obligation to the planet alive, no matter if we're leaving. I feel it is an imperative that I do whatever I can to register the sorrows of the planet. I mean, we have to remember that much of the grief we're feeling isn't ours. It isn't personal. We are literally feeling the sorrows of the watersheds. We are literally feeling. I mean, when the Gulf oil spill happened in 2010, I was waking up in the middle of the night crying, hearing the sound of dolphins in my ears. Mm. I was hearing the shorebirds, suffocating from oil.
Yeah.
That's 2,000 miles away from my home. But my psyche doesn't know that. My psyche is profoundly linked to what is happening there or here or anywhere. We are penetrated by that. So why do grief work? So that we can register the sorrows of the planet, and then we can do whatever we can, whatever we're obligated to do morally and spiritually, to try to prepare whatever is coming so that they have a better chance to survive and to continue. They have a right to that.
Oh, I absolutely love that. Thank you so much for that.
You're so welcome.
You know, in your magnificent little book, which I want to encourage everyone to get, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, you include a couple of stories about your experience in West Africa, specifically in Burkina Faso with the Dagari tribe. And both you and I have worked closely with our African shaman friend who you mentioned a while ago, Maladoma Somme from that tribe. And Maladoma leads grief rituals all over the world, and I've had the privilege of attending several of them, but you've actually gone to his tribe in West Africa and taken part in a grief ritual in the Dagari tribe. So, first of all, what is a grief ritual, and can you say a little bit about how that experience impacted you? What was your biggest takeaway?
Well, a grief ritual is a community event whose intention it is to help, well, it's twofold. One of them is to help the soul of the departed person get to the land of the ancestors. And they say you can only do that on a river of tears. And the second part is to provide a container for the people who are in deep grief to fully let the sorrow down. And the grief ritual there for them takes 3 days. And as you move through the ritual, you are moving in and out of different stages of participation. You might at one point just simply be watching, witnessing from up on a hill. And then another state would be a place of singing. You might be dancing. You might be one of the mourners or the weepers trying to help keep the energy moving for 3 days. Or you might be one of the people in deep grief. And then there's another group called the containers themselves who are there to protect the grievers from getting too far into their grief so that they don't return back to the place of the living. And the ritual is a profound event to communally address the fact that we are holding, a family, a section of our village who have entered into a parallel world. They're no longer necessarily walking in the daylight world. They've entered into a shadowed world what we call a time of living in the ashes. And they need the help of the village to do the deep work of grieving. So what happens in this process of deep grief, which in many cultures goes on for the period of time for about a year, is you are reshaped by this time. You are made, you are broken open to a deeper realization of the both the fragility and the exquisite quality of being a human being, being in this body. And you go through a period of time where you are ripened, and you come back up out of that time of descent as someone now we call carrying gravitas, carrying a wisdom that can only come from the thorough descent into that territory. So part of what I came away with is how necessary it is to have communal rituals that allow people in sorrow and in grief the permission to do that work. See, when we privatize grief, which is what we've done in our culture, we privatize everything. Now we're almost privatizing water, which is a very dangerous thought. But psychology has even taught us to privatize, you know, own your own feelings, which is, I think, also another dangerous thought. What if, again, if I'm privatizing my grief, I have to do both jobs, containment and release, and I can't. So I'm left performing only one job, which is containment. And I become this kind of a chronically containing of this grief, which I call recycling my grief. So we chew on these same bones over and over again, sometimes for decades, because the mechanism that we need to fully release it has not been provided. So I'd say the biggest takeaway for me is that we require, the soul requires these interventions that are communally based, because grief has never, ever in our entire history as a species been private until now. So it's the restoration of the original context through which the soul was able to mediate and mitigate deep loss.
Wow. Oh, that is so profound. And, you know, I have facilitated some smaller grief rituals in my work and from time to time. And, you know, what I notice, people talk to me about what difference it makes to be able to grieve with another person in the community,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to I have to be with this all by myself.
Well, the thing what happens if we are facing it all by ourselves is basically on some level the psyche knows we can't.
Right.
We turn away. And that's part of what's happening collectively for us, is if I have to face this on my own, there's actually almost a wisdom in shutting down.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
We cannot face this on our own. And consequently, we have a lot of people who have hardened and are much more preoccupied with survival than with living. And it's those people we need mature men and women who are able to really take in what's happening and be responsive to that. But the only way I can see that happens is in that setting in which the heart has the full permission to address what it is that it's carrying. And that requires at least a small number of people to help me set it down. You know, every time we do a ritual, there are, you know, part of what I've seen, Carolyn, is that even for people who have never done this before, when they are kneeling side by side with somebody else at the grief shrine, when the ritual is over, they say, you know, oddly, somehow, this was very familiar. And I say, yes, this is deeply wired into our deep time inheritance as an individual of this species. We've been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years. It's only been in the last, you know, several hundred years that we've forgotten how to do this. And consequently, again, we're back to carrying it all on our own, and we can't.
Yeah. In a moment, I want us to talk a little bit about the relationship between grief and joy. And we're going to have a song. And since we're talking about Africa, I'm aware that three dear friends of mine who are spending the winter in South Africa writing are probably listening tonight. And so I want to dedicate this song to them and also allow the song to introduce a theme that Francis and I are going to explore, which is how grief and joy travel together. So without explaining the obvious, let's listen. And Leslie, Brad, and Victoria, this song is for you and for all of our listeners.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose these walking blues. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. She was physically forgotten, but then she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She said, "You've taken me for granted because I please you. Wearing these diamonds." And I could say, ooh, as if everybody knows what I'm talking about. As if everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about diamonds on the soles of the shoes. For his ordinary shoes. She said, "Honey, take me dancing," but they ended up by sleeping in a doorway by the bodegas and the lights on over Broadway, wearing diamonds on the soles of their shoes. And I could say, ooh, everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. I'm talking about
soles of my shoes.
Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
Great song.
My shoes, your shoes. Yeah. And in a minute, we're going to talk a little bit about grief and joy, but I just want to remind folks of my upcoming webinar, which starts on March the 6th. It's a webinar called Befriending the Dark Emotions in Turbulent Times. We're going to start out with a free session on March 6th with my friend Andrew Harvey, and then we're going to continue for another four sessions. It is a focus on how do we befriend fear, anger, grief, despair, and joy in turbulent times. So if you want to get more information and register for the event, please go to my website at carolynbaker.net. You'll probably see lots of notices on Facebook about this from me, but please go to my website and learn more and register. www.carolynbaker.net. So, I want to encourage everyone to get hold of Francis' book, Entering the Healing Ground, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World. You can find it in several places, including his beautiful website, wisdombridge.net. And one of the things that you mention in the book, Francis, is how our joy is deepened, enhanced, and made more palpable as a result of grieving. I'm wondering if you can briefly share that story that you tell in the book about the dagger, a woman that you encountered who was smiling so radiantly after the grief ritual.
Well, I remember walking up to this woman who was just, you know, as you say, kind of radiant. She was just ebullient. And I said, "You have so much joy." And her response was, "That's because I cry a lot." And it stunned me. And it wasn't, "That's because I shop a lot," or, you know, "I have a lot," or "have a new car," or "I keep myself busy." It's because I cry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remembered the wonderful phrase of William Blake where he said, "The deeper the sorrow, the greater the joy."
Yes.
And we live in what I call a flatline culture. When we refuse to go into the depths, when we refuse to drop into that place of sorrow, loss, and grief, we simultaneously compress the region of joy. And we're left with this narrow band of emotions that we're allowed to occupy. And so we end up requiring stimulants and stimulation to feel like we have a pulse. So part of the work of recovering our joy is by opening up and recovering our capacity to feel grief, to feel sorrow. I can tell you that almost every grief ritual we do ends in this feeling of almost an ecstatic state. We are giddy, we are happy, we are joyous to see each other with our faces wet from grieving, and something is opened up in the heart, and we are freed from cynicism, bitterness, loneliness. We come back into the what I call the commons of the soul. This is our shared state. This is the place where we meet one another, where we truly meet one another. And that is a joyous state when we come out of our isolation and our loneliness.
Well, you know, that's been my experience as well. When I've participated in grief rituals and when I have led them, just invariably, without exception, people come out with incredible depth of joy and a sense of really being connected with each other in ways that surpass, you know, our typical socialization in this culture that is designed to connect us, but doesn't.
Well, I'm reminded of Michael Mead's, he talked about three layers of experience that we encounter. The first layer is the social layer. You know, how are things going? Hey, good to see you. Nice
mm-hmm.
day. Sunny. Yeah. Have a great one. And then this third layer, which is this deep connection between hearts and souls, where we feel a sense of unity and communitas, as
right.
Mr. Turner would call it. But there's this second layer, which deals with anger, loss, hatred, grief, envy. And he said we can't get from layer one to layer three without going through layer two.
Mm.
And we avoid layer two like the plague in this culture.
Yes,
and
we do.
So unfortunately, and then unconsciously, we become obsessed with layer two. We become incredibly violent. We become incredibly kind of consumed by death. We become the most death extending culture that we've ever seen. So we need to consciously and intentionally navigate that second layer. But again, that, I think that requires community and it requires ritual. Because I think that's the mechanism that's strong enough and fierce enough to invite in those very difficult emotions.
Yes, and without those, we can't really do that work.
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, in this culture, there's a lot of confusion between sadness, depression, and grief. So what is the difference, in your opinion, between grief and depression? And why do you think there would be less depression if in our culture if people grieved more?
Well, you know, as a therapist of over 30 years, the most common symptom that comes in the door is depression. I mean, that's what they're complaining about. But it's rarely, you know, a genuine clinical depression. What it typically is undigested loss. They are carrying years, decades of losses that have not been honored in any substantial way. And like I said before, grief comes from the word gravis, which means heavy. And if we are consistently gathering together losses that are not being addressed and honored, that heaviness begins to depress us. It begins to weigh down on us. The thing that's very different between grief and depression is that grief is a very alive state. It's a very vital state. We are moving. We are feeling. You know, the emotion is circulating through us. Depression oftentimes feels like a flatness, like an absence, like a deadening of life. It's hard to get up in the morning. It's hard to feel anything. People in grief, if it's being actively courted, it's what I call taking up our apprenticeship with sorrow. If that apprenticeship is being well tended, we are actually nourished in grief. Something comes to us in that time of sorrow that actually, again, feeds the heart in a very unexpected way. And we become riper, more, I would say, like emotionally intelligent human beings.
That is such a lovely paradox. I just really, really like that. Thank you so much for explaining that. I want to begin now to open up the line to callers. If you have a comment or a question for Francis or for me, I would really, really like to hear from you. So the number again to call is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, and give us your question or comment. As we're waiting for callers, I want to ask another question, Francis. In your work and your writing, you talk a lot about the soul. Now, some of our listeners may not know what you mean by that, and I'm sure some of our listeners don't even believe the soul exists. So I'm wondering if you could speak to the reality of the soul and what you mean by it.
Another one of those daunting questions.
Yes, I know.
When I use the term soul, I'm using it basically interchangeably with psyche. I'm not trying to talk about a metaphysical reality or a religious concept. I'm talking about a way of seeing, a way of perceiving that looks through things with an eye towards depth. Soul, in that sense, is drawn to things that bring us into the deeper experiences of life. You know, when we have a conversation with someone where we share deep, vulnerable feelings, we say that was a soulful conversation. Or we're listening to music that touches us and brings tears to our eyes, we could say that's soul music. So that quality of soul is what I'm talking about. It's a way of being moved by things, by words, by images, by sounds, by touch. Soul brings us into the moment of vulnerability, brings us closer to death, to the places of longing in the heart for intimacy, for belonging, for connection. So that's the kind of a felt sense of soul as I'm using it. And again, not in a religious sense, but really more in a dimensional sense of where it takes us.
Right, and I love the synonym, you know, or sort of the synonym with psyche. I believe that we have a caller on the line. Kim, you're calling in. Thank you for calling in. What is your question or comment?
Hi, Carolyn. It's Kim, also known as Hecate Questo on Facebook. And,
oh, yeah.
Francis, I worked with you and Maladoma at Ghost Ranch back in the... being here.
Oh, did we lose her?
I'm here. I'm calling on Skype from Australia, so I hope this is working.
Okay, I can hear you.
We can hear you now.
Okay. My question is, how can we rejigger thinking about grief when we're not dead yet, but yet that's what I'm grieving over?
Well, we have to appreciate that grief comes into our beings in many, many ways. And it's already in your body. It's already there for what I call ancestral grief, or the grief that we deal with from our own personal losses, or the losses that surround us every day of the earth. Grief is there. We don't have to go looking for it. What we have to do is be responsive to it. And that requires, more frequently than not, enough companions. I think what we can do, I mean, I often recommend this, and, you know, we don't have to have an elaborate grief ritual. One night we can call several friends over and say, tonight we're going to talk about sorrow. Tonight we're going to let ourselves be honest about the wounds of sorrow that we carry in our hearts, and have enough permission, along with some agreements, that we don't try to fix anything. Because grief is not a problem to be solved. It's an emotion. It's a state of being that needs to be witnessed. And we're waiting. The psyche is deeply waiting for someone to say, I see you. I hear you. When we do the grief rituals, when you return from the grief shrine, you're always welcomed back by the village. And any number of people will whisper in your ears, I saw you. And thank you. You took a small sip out of the communal cup of loss, and I deeply appreciate that. And that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for some signal from the community that I did what I had to do. I hope that gives you some sense, Hecate.
It does, Francis. And what else has just become clear to me in listening to you is that it matters not whether I am certain or correct about the demise of our species and so many others, because the reality that I'm in is worth grieving over right now, and I don't need to go to any future extinction to express my grief.
Absolutely
so thank
not.
You.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely not. Now is the time, because it's already present. It's already in our bones. It's already in our hearts. It's already in our bodies, waiting for that permission to be set down. And again, what the psyche is waiting for, what the soul is waiting for, is a small circle of people giving us permission to say, this is, as Neruda would say, I know the earth, and I am sad.
Thank you for your call, Kim. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Carolyn.
Good to hear from you.
Okay, our next caller is Audrey. Audrey, what's your comment or question?
Well, hello, the two of you, and blessings for this amazing breadth of work that you both are committed to doing. I became very aware last August when Fukushima became such an issue, and I have inundated myself with information. But what I'm finding is, as I go through the grieving process, I actually have to feel it all the way through my heart. And when I do, it rocks my boat all the time. And I've been doing this ad nonstop since August. And what I see and feel and understand now is that the grief process is the way through it's the gateway of the heart. And how do you share with people in community that don't want to hear about this when it's actually right with us? How, I know you said grief, you know, doing the doing be responsive and have companions, but when everyone's turning a blind ear, not a deaf ear to me, when I am creating a site about it, they don't even want to know about Fukushima survival or anything like that.
Well, what I thank you for your question, and what I've seen at every grief ritual we've done is that this earth grief, as cellist Glendenning calls it, is in everyone's hearts, whether we acknowledge it or not. I mean, part of what I'm sensing is that the denial is finally breaking,
mm-hmm.
and it's
mm-hmm.
beginning to crack sufficiently. So I want to just applaud you for your willingness to address that and to keep speaking it, but I would hopefully you will find, I don't know where you are, but...
Colorado. Western Colorado.
Okay. You know, just to have...
We have an awakened community. It's just broaching the subject is... they're not ready to hear it, or I'm not couching it in the way that they can hear it.
Audrey, one of the things you could do is email me, because I also live in Colorado, carolyn@carolynbaker.net, and
yeah.
we can talk about that.
Awesome. All right.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Thank you, Audrey.
And before we have the next question, I just want to make sure that people know that you do work with clients and you do facilitate grief rituals. And as you do that, just tell me just briefly what the effect is in their lives, because you're going to be doing a grief ritual in Northern California in March, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Would you say more about that and tell us how people can learn more or register for it?
Well, unfortunately, they can't because it's already full.
Oh.
I mean, it's so interesting, you know, just as a quick aside, to follow up on that last comment about I think denial is breaking. When I first started offering grief rituals about 15 years ago, it was a coaxing process. I had to really hold hands for, you know, many phone conversations to convince people to come. Mm-hmm. Now, almost the moment that we put it up there, within a few days, it's full. And so our grief rituals are often, you know, have long waiting lists. So something is changing.
Mm-hmm.
The willingness to address this, and I think the recognition that doing it communally is vital, has really shifted. But back to the question, what is the effect on their lives?
Yes.
Well, I think they become much more available to their lives. They become much more alive, you know, whether they're, you know, as parents to their children or participants in their community, or just, you know, we have to have some sense of the delight of this incredible privilege of being in this body and not simply enduring our life to the end. But actually what happens as a consequence of doing the grief work is that some measure of delight and enchantment return, and we begin to see color again more vibrantly and touch the clerk at the store with a little bit more kindness. We're not hardened and, you know, and just afraid of life, but something really seems to alter in the very way that I engage my existence and those that I come in touch with.
Thank you so much for that. That's also been my experience when I have facilitated grief rituals and workshops. We have Maya on hold. Go ahead.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I'm enjoying the program. I'm listening through the telephone in New York City. And I'd like to, I have a question and a concern, but I'd also like, before the end of the program, to get the full name of the guest. I understand it's Francis is the first name. And more slowly, if you would say the title of the book. I find this discussion very interesting because I've recently found myself in a situation with a very close friend who is somewhat of a cynically oriented person, and recently He's, you know, he just disappears at times. When he gets sick, he was sick. I think he had pneumonia. He doesn't, for some reason, doesn't want the support and love of certain of his friends. And it seems like I've been rejected in terms of just trying to get a phone call returned. I mean, this is someone like I've had 6 and 7 hours conversations with on the phone, and then I have to back off because I have to eat or get some rest. So I'd like to know what I could do, because I found myself moving toward anger, being angry and somewhat rageful that somebody is close would, you know, just kind of throw me under the bus or drop me like a hot potato. So I'd like some guidance from Francis as to how I can stay more centered. And you know, it makes me very isolated because of the, you know, someone I depend on in terms of closeness. And what type of ritual? I hear this talk about rituals, but somebody who's on their own. And maybe I can send off a link to Carolyn's webinar. Please mention the date on that again. And I'll listen over my phone as to what I might be able to do to help me to cope with this.
Let's give Francis plenty of time to answer. Go ahead, Francis.
Well, it sounds like, and thank you for your question, Maya, it sounds like your friend is going through his own experience, his own encounter with loss. Illness can be a deep source of grief. But what happens frequently, if we again privatize that, anything that we privatize tend to attract shame to it. And whatever attracts shame to it tends to make us want to withdraw and avoid contact and vulnerability. And this is often the case, I think particularly for the conditioning that men go through in this culture, is that weakness and vulnerability lead us to feel too exposed. And one of the quickest and most effective ways we can cope with that is to withdraw and to pull away from contact. Mm. So what I would suggest you try to do is that when he's well and making contact with you again, just softly inquire about, I wonder what happens to you when you feel ill. Do you feel like you don't want to burden me? Do you feel like you're weakened? And do you feel like this is not okay to share with me? Because this has nothing to do with you. This has a lot to do with the messages that he's living with about how to cope with feeling weakened and, you know, and not being able to be strong and in control. I hope that helps a little bit.
Yes,
okay,
thank you so much.
Okay, Mayette, our guest's name is Francis Weller, W-E-L-L-E-R. You can contact him at Wisdom Bridge. That's all one word, wisdombridge.net. You can find out about my Befriending the Dark Emotions in Turbulent Times webinar by going to my website, carolynbaker.net. That's Carolyn with a Y. And we have Edward on hold. We have just a couple of minutes left. Edward, what's your question or comment?
Hello, Carolyn. One of the more difficult things for me in terms of thinking about the situation that we're in and where it can possibly lead, and probably where it will certainly lead, is the phenomenon of having pre-knowledge of something bad going to happen in the future, when you have to suffer it again and again and again. Whereas, you know, like with our own individual deaths, it's like if we don't know when it's going to happen, then we don't have to ever think about it. But if, you know, when we're confronted with this, the reality of it on such a large scale, the grief becomes so overwhelming. And the sense of mourning is so powerful, and the sense of isolation when no one wants to talk about it. You know, I think that the idea of grief counseling and work in that area is a very positive attribute that that we should all be concerned about at this point in time. But I just want to call in and thank you so much for having the show. And I really like the Paul Simon tune, one of my favorites. And I'll just and now, if you have a few comments for me, you know, and on terms of thinking about the future, you know, I would like to hear what you have to say. Thank you so much. Good night.
Thanks, Edward.
Thanks, Edward. That's a really profound and essential question. And what I would say, are we still there?
Hello?
Carolyn?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. What I would say, Edward, is that in our work, we talk about the sign or the mark of a true, mature man or woman is their capacity to hold grief in one hand and gratitude in the other. And if we only pick up one of those, we can be crushed. If we only pick up grief, over time, we will become so overburdened by that reality that our hearts will ultimately become brittle and bitter. And if we only pick up gratitude, we will lack a certain sympathy, a certain sympathetic sense of what's going on, and we will actually lack compassion. So we actually need both of these things. I remember working with a woman once, and I tell this story in the book, about her lying on the floor in my office crying over the Iraq war and just sobbing for 15, 20 minutes. And at one point I kneeled towards her and I said, did you notice that the plum blossoms were out today? And she said, no. I said, did you happen to notice that the mustard was in bloom? She said, no. I said, we can't possibly tolerate the horrors of Iraq without plum blossoms and mustard blooms. We have to be able to keep our eye open to the exquisite beauty of this planet, all the while knowing what is happening. We have to be able to take in the daily nutrition of beauty in order to really be able to confront some of what is most horrific on the horizon. I think that is absolutely essential as a homeopathic medicine for our souls in this time.
That is such a beautiful answer, Francis. And, you know, it reminds me of a poem by Rashani, a contemporary poet. And I'll just briefly recite it as we bring the show down toward its ending. The poem is, there is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken, a shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable. There is a sorrow beyond all grief which leads to joy, and a fragility out of whose depths emerges strength. There is a hollow space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctioned into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside that is unbreakable and whole while learning to sing.
Beautiful.
So, Francis, do you have a couple more words for us as we bring the show to a close?
Well, first, gratitude to you, Carolyn, for inviting me to be with you. And I think the thing I always try to stress for people is the necessity of finding at least one or two others to try to help you hold what you are carrying in your heart. We cannot do this alone. And, I mean, we have people coming to our grief ritual from Florida, from Massachusetts, from the United Kingdom. There's a deep hunger for times and places where we get to tell the truth about it, what it is that we're carrying in our hearts. And I hope everyone can find small places of refuge where they get to say what is in their hearts and in their souls. This way, we get to continue to participate in whatever way we can, in whatever mending we can participate in the world. And may that be so.
Francis, I really want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. And again, people can contact you at wisdombridge.net. Thank you to all listeners and callers. I'll be back with you again next week with another very special guest. Good night.
Thank you.